Have you ever wondered what happened to the legendary Chuck Norris? We recently saw a video he made and it was shocking. He's in his 80s and still kicking butt, working out, staying active, and even has plenty of energy left over for his grandkids. He did this by just making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife tried too, and she says she feels 10 years younger. Her body looks leaner and she has energy all day. With the stress of everyday life, on top of the toll all the world's terrible news takes on us, it's more important than ever to stay healthy. My Morning Kick is the way to do it. Chuck made a video that explains everything. Make sure you watch it by going to mymorningkick.com/useful. It'll change the way you think about your health. Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/useful. You won't believe how simple it is.
Your next great vacation might be something you've never even considered. A private yacht in a beautiful location just for you and your closest friends and family. Explore the beaches of the Virgin Islands, the ancient shores of Greece, or the tropical paradise of Tahiti. This is not a cruise. This is a yacht charter vacation with The Moorings. And it's easier than you think. With hundreds of award-winning yachts to choose from, located in over 20 beautiful sailing destinations, the world is in your hands. Whether you're an experienced boater or looking for a more genuine once-in-a-lifetime vacation, The Moorings can make your dream a reality. Call us today and start your journey to your next great escape. Your private yacht awaits at moorings.com.
Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here. It's great to have you. Our website, as always, is usefulidiotspodcast.com. Go there, support the show, keep us going. And I believe we still have very limited number of slots left for this crazy deal we're doing where you get a year of Useful Idiots for 30% off.
Crazy useful deal for Useful Idiots fans.
Yes. So the link is in the show description. Click on that and take advantage of this limited time offer.
Act fast, guys. Act fast. Don't regret it. Don't do something you'll regret later, which is to fail to take advantage of this great deal.
Speaking of a great deal, we have a great deal of content for you today.
Oh, nice segue. Yeah, that we
do. Thank you. And let's get it going with our four basic food groups.
So, Aaron, what do we have for Democrats Suck?
For Democrats Suck, we're going to turn to this really shocking news, for me at least, this week, when the International Criminal Court requested arrest warrants for the leaders of both Israel and Hamas. Personally, I have to say I was surprised. I did not think the ICC would do it. I've always seen them as sort of a geopolitical tool of the West. There's a reason they call it the International Caucasian Court, because they basically only indict African leaders. Occasionally, they'll go after like a designated bad guy. In the U.S.'s eyes, like Putin or Milosevic. But they actually indicted or sought an indictment for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, along with three Hamas leaders. And the Biden administration is very upset. So let's look at how Joe Biden handled the news.
Let me be clear. We reject the ICC's application for arrest warrants against Israeli leaders.
Who claps for that? Like, wouldn't you, if you were supportive of Biden's view and against what the ICC did, wouldn't you boo?
Yeah, it's an odd thing to get excited about. It's like you're not at a rock concert or you know, like a pop concert. Let's condemn
the ICC. Woohoo! Whee!
Yeah. We don't like seeing people being held accountable for genocide.
Wonder if anyone like took out a lighter. Waved it around.
Whatever these warrants may imply, there is no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
By the way, that was a major talking point going around. Everyone, all of Israel's defenders were claiming there was no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
Well, this is the point, right? Because they can't actually dispute the case on the merits because they're being accused of war crimes, massacring civilians and depriving them of basic aid, which Israeli leaders openly promised to do. So given how overwhelming the evidence is, they can't actually attack this case on the merits. So they're creating the straw man issue of the ICC drawing an equivalence between Hamas and Israel, which the ICC did not do. They just happened to announce the charges at the same time. Right. Now, by the way, I mean, if you want to get into it, I agree there's no equivalence between Israel and Hamas.
Right.
First of all, the crimes of Israel are exponentially higher. And, you know, from a legal standpoint, there is no equivalency between an occupying power and a militant group that resists it. That doesn't mean that Hamas didn't commit war crimes. Like, you don't have carte blanche to commit war crimes if you're resisting military occupation.
Right. Which Hamas civilians. Did. Yeah.
But in terms of the equivalence, yeah, it's not even close. Israel's not only committing mass murder, but it's a state party with obligations because it's carrying out an occupation. Palestinians have legal right to resist occupation. They don't have the right to kill civilians.
Right.
But they, or commit war crimes against civilians, but they have the right to resist. So Biden's right, there's no equivalence, just for the wrong reasons.
Exactly.
And it's clear Israel wants to do all it can to ensure civilian protection. But let me be clear, contrary to allegations against Israel made by the International Court of Justice, what's happening is not genocide. We reject that.
Oh, not genocide.
We stand with Israel and the threats against its security.
I mean, so again, you notice how he's not challenging the case on the merits. He creates the straw man of an equivalency, which the ICC did not do. And then he talks about the ICJ case, which is separate, right, where Israel is accused of genocide. The ICC, which has requested these indictments, isn't alleging genocide. So you can see how desperate they are right there and how angry they are, because they actually cannot challenge this case on its merits. They bring up two unrelated aspects of this that don't speak to the merits of the ICC case.
Right. Really flimsy, pathetic.
There has, of course, been a bipartisan freakout over this ICC move, and we're going to hear from the Republicans on this, Katie, when you do Republicans Suck very shortly. But let's look at how Democrats are handling this news. And Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, went before Congress, where a Republican senator, Jim Risch, who's just an ultra hawk, ultra neocon, basically said to him that we want to take action against the ICC. And Antony Blinken, in true bipartisan fashion, said, absolutely, we want to take action against the ICC too.
The extremely wrongheaded decision by the ICC prosecutor yesterday, the shameful equivalence implied between Hamas and the leadership of Israel, I think that only complicates the prospects for getting such an agreement. We'll continue to forge ahead to do that, but that decision, as you said, on so many levels, is totally wrongheaded. And we'll be happy to work with Congress, with this committee, on an appropriate response.
So there we go. That is Antony Blinken siding with Republicans and saying, yes, we're going to respond to the ICC. And I presume that means, I don't know, reviving sanctions on the ICC, which the U.S. has imposed before when they tried to go after U.S. forces or thought about going after U.S. forces in Afghanistan. There's also the Hague Invasion Act, which was passed during the war on terror, where basically we threatened to invade the Hague if ever they prosecuted anybody for U.S. war crimes. So
embarrassing.
Who knows what kind of fun things they'll come up with. But
right. That's
the bipartisan response. Now, what's extra ironic about all this is that all of a sudden when the ICC tries to hold Israel accountable for war crimes, ICC is it's out of line. It doesn't have jurisdiction. We're going to even sanction it. We're going to do whatever. But when the ICC goes after Russia, it's a much different story. And here is Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin vowing that, yes, while we completely reject the ICC when it comes to Israel, when it comes to them accusing Russia of war crimes, it's full steam ahead. We're going to keep cooperating with them.
Regarding the question of whether or not we'll continue to provide support to the ICC with respect to crimes that are committed in Ukraine, yes, we continue that work.
So how's that going to work? They're going to keep working with the ICC when it comes to going after Russia, right? But if they also, I don't know, pass sanctions against the ICC, is that going to be awkward?
What are they saying about the ICC's position on Russia?
Yeah, and it's like, if they're actually working with the ICC as they've been doing, they've been cooperating. Like, how practically are they going to do that? Because, for example, if they sanction the ICC, that means that they can't talk to them and they can't work with them. So, how are they going to do? Like, is there going to be some carve out where they're going to walk into the office and be like, all right, we're here to talk about Russia, and here's like a little case file. Here's like some data like we've gathered about Russia, but also here's like I have to slap you on the wrist too, because I have to turn my back on you because I'm not supposed to talk to you about because you went after Israel too. It's just going to be very awkward.
It's awkward, yeah. It's like telling a friend that they have terrible judgment while also agreeing with that friend trashing someone else.
I mean, we've all been there. We've all been there. I mean, you know, it's maybe very, who knows, maybe it's very like relatable behavior by the Biden administration to be so mercurial. But
well, it's like relatable hypocrisy. It's relatable awkwardness. Yeah. Because they're being such hypocrites. Yeah.
Yes. It's awkward because of pictures like this. This is a photo op that was done back when the ICC was the greatest thing in the world because they were going after Russia. So here is a group of senators visiting the ICC, including the prosecutor who just sought the Israel indictments, Karim Khan. And he's there with a group of visiting Democratic senators, including my friend Chris Coons, my train travel partner. And the currently on trial Bob Menendez, who's facing a massive corruption case in New York City, you know, accused of taking things like gold bars and having lots of cash in his home to help a halal food distributor in the U.S. So, you know, it's just the U.S. is a very fickle friend. Very, very fickle.
It is a fickle friend. Fair weather friend. Yeah. You know, also Menendez's wife killed someone. I believe it was vehicular manslaughter. She ran someone over with her car.
Yes, that's that is another case that she caught. And it was rumored that Bob Menendez's legal strategy was going to entail throwing her under the bus.
Under the car.
Under the car. There we go.
All right. Well, for Republican suck, let's see how Lindsey Graham, Senator Lindsey Graham, reacted to the ICC request for arrest warrants.
So we, hopefully, together will find a way to arrest our displeasure with the ICC, because if they'll do this to Israel, we're next. This group tried to come after our soldiers. Yeah, you can clap all you want to. They tried to come after our soldiers in Afghanistan, but reason prevailed. So at the end of the day here, what I hope to happen is that we level sanctions against the ICC for this outrage to not only help our friends in Israel, but protect ourselves over time. Ms. Secretary, your statement yesterday was excellent. The president's statement was excellent. Senator Schumer's statement on the floor was excellent about the outrage here. They have destroyed the notion of complementarity. They have misled people in the United States Senate about their intention, and they shall and will pay a price. Ms. Secretary, I appreciate what you've said. It is now time for us to act.
A couple interesting things there. Notice how bipartisan, as you mentioned before, Aaron, how bipartisan the condemnation of the ICC is. There's really no daylight there. But also, I like how honest Lindsey Graham is. He's saying if they go after Israel, they could go after us.
From Lindsey Graham's mouth to God's ears. That's what I say.
Exactly. Yeah. But it's funny that he's saying that part out loud, because he's kind of exposing the fact that, I mean, to him, obviously, he's claiming that it would be as preposterous to go after the United States as it would be to go after Israel. But for anyone with a working brain, of course, what this really means is the U.S. is afraid of the ICC for daring to go after Israel. But also imagine if they went after the United States, which would be equally unacceptable. But the United States and Israel is united by its common values, including war crimes.
And just on the issue of Gaza alone, the ICC should be going after the U.S. because the U.S. is equally complicit. Right. Israel cannot be doing what it's doing without U.S. support, military, diplomatic, at all levels. So bring it on.
Another Republican who had an interesting response to the ICC decision is House Speaker Mike Johnson.
America first.
America should punish the ICC and put Karim Khan back in his place. And if the ICC is allowed to threaten Israel's leaders, we know that America will be next. There is a reason that we've never endorsed the International Criminal Court, because it is a direct affront to our own sovereignty. We don't put any international body above American sovereignty, and Israel doesn't do that either. Congress is reviewing all of our options right now. We have some very aggressive legislation that we're going to push as quickly as possible. It will impose sanctions. And if the ICC moves forward with its absurd warrant arrest or request, this is going to be an even bigger international problem.
And what does Mike Johnson mean when he says putting Khan back in his place? Well, we actually have a pretty good idea of that, because this is what Karim Khan said during a CNN interview about things he was told by certain elected leaders.
Strategic interests And of course, I've had some elected leaders speak to me and be very blunt. This court is built for Africa and for thugs like Putin, was what one senior leader told me.
So how dare you, Karim Khan, how dare you not follow our rules, our very hypocritical, unprincipled, selective application of international law? And as you know, and as we told you, Karim, you're only allowed to go after Africa and then people like Putin.
You're not the International Criminal Court. You're the International Caucasian Court. So right. Go after African leaders and maybe a few non-Africans if we really, really don't like them, like Vladimir Putin. But that's it. Nobody else. I'd love to know, of course, from which country that senior official who he's quoting comes from. I'm going to guess it comes from the US or UK.
Yeah.
But it's really a mask off moment. It's really a mask off moment. The contempt that our elites have for international law, for all this talk they have about the rules-based international order. Well, I guess the International Criminal Court trying to hold war criminals accountable is not a part of the rules-based international order anymore, because now it's actually trying to apply some standards to people who we're in league with.
Also, isn't that so disgusting to say that they're going to put him in his place?
Oh, yeah. It's very racist language.
It's so racist. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Put him in his place. Exactly. Yeah. But that's so that's gross. America First or Mike Johnson.
Right.
America First means doing Israel's bidding. It means, like he talks about, our sovereignty, respect for our sovereignty. Well, where's the respect for our sovereignty in, letting Israel basically destroy the U.S. reputation, its professed commitment to international law, letting its lobby groups buy off Congress members constantly with its, all the money that AIPAC spends on congressional races, all the meddling it does in U.S. democracy? Where's the concern about U.S. sovereignty there for a so-called America Firster?
It's really America kind of Firster. It's America tied with Israel Firster.
Yeah.
So what do we got for Isn't That Weird, Aaron?
For Isn't That Weird, we're going to go over to Germany where, we're journalists here, right? So we're just reporting this news. We're bringing it to you. I don't want to put imagery of a guy licking toilets on the air, but this is what a German politician did. His name is Martin Neumeier, and he went viral after he filmed himself licking public toilets. So let's go to the tape.
A German politician is under fire after he was seen licking public toilets in a series of inappropriate videos. German politician Martin Neumeier allegedly licked the public facilities, claiming it was part of his punishment. It's unclear what the punishment was for and shared no further details. Two other disturbing videos of the politician have since been removed.
There we go. The categories Isn't That Weird. The imagery is of a German politician licking toilets and toilet implements. So I think that's weird.
I mean, I think we fulfilled our duty as providing a weird.
He's apparently a candidate with the FDP, which is a German right-wing party.
Always the right-wingers who do really weird shit.
Yeah. Now, listen, have we done our due diligence on this story? Have we gone deep and researched this? No, we have not. So I don't know. Is this maybe some kind of scam or something, or
like a deep fake, like AI?
How senior a candidate is this guy? I don't really know. But all I know is we saw on Twitter that a German politician was licking toilets and we thought
that's enough for us. Yeah.
It's weird. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So for Isn't That Terrible, let's hear what once a very long time ago, slightly relevant person, John Lovitz, had to say about Bernie Sanders on Fox News.
And Bernie Sanders is he's always been, I think I said it before and I'll say it again. He's a self-loathing Jew. And there's a lot of them. And, why do you say that? I go, well, it's clear as a bell. He's not for Israel. They have to stop this war. Why isn't he condemning Hamas for starting it? What about that? And whatever you think of Trump, the fact is that he's done more for Israel than any president in the history of this country.
Okay, so John Lovitz, who, full disclosure, I've fought with on Twitter over whether or not Israel is committing genocide. A couple things here. He takes a really long time to make points that are really not very intelligent or well thought or thought-provoking. You'd think that saying such garbage, it would kind of flow, roll off the tongue more. So there's that. The other thing is that he accuses Bernie Sanders of being a self-loathing Jew because he doesn't support Israel, which is in itself an anti-Semitic trope, right? That's the dual loyalty trope, suggesting that all Jews support Israel, conflating being Jewish with supporting Israel, which is something anti-Semites do. And he says Bernie hasn't condemned Hamas. Now, we on the show have talked about how not only has he condemned Hamas, but he kind of put the blame on them for starting the war on October 7th, which, of course, I'm sure John Lovitz likes. So for all those reasons, that's my, isn't that terrible?
So, Katie, what I'm hearing you say is that you're a critic of the critic.
Yeah, I'm a hater of the hater.
No, but you're a critic of the critic because
oh,
he was.
Oh, I get it. Okay.
The star of the animated show, The Critic.
Sorry. Yes. I'm sorry. That went over my head for a second. Okay. I forgot about that. Yeah. You're right. Sorry. That's true. Yeah.
It was a short lived sitcom. I don't recall watching it, but I remember it was on after The Simpsons. So,
okay.
But yes, The Critic has turned into a critic of anybody who isn't kissing Israel's feet. And that includes Bernie Sanders because he raises some human rights concerns about mass murder. So right. John Lovitz is not happy about that. And yeah, well, listen, if you're a Hollywood star and you would like, no matter how marginal you are at this point, if you are there to defend Israel and it's mass murder, it's extermination of civilians, you'll get a spot on TV.
Right. Fox News will have you. Yeah. Probably all the networks will have you. Yeah.
Maybe he'll even get a new sitcom. Who knows?
Right.
Who knows?
Right.
Yeah.
The Zionist Critic.
That sounds like a terrible show. His fictional show would be just as terrible as that clip we just saw.
Exactly. Maybe he and Deborah Messing could star in a buddy movie where they both go to Israel. Because Deborah Messing, of course, has been to Israel.
Be careful what you wish for. That's going to get greenlit tomorrow. Yeah.
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 Noah Tishby could direct it.
Oh, yeah.
And Brett Gelman could star in it also.
Oh, this is a nightmare. This is turning into a nightmare. All right. And those are your four basic food groups. For this week's guest, we are joined by Anthony Lowenstein. He is an independent journalist, filmmaker, and co-founder of Declassified Australia. His latest book is the global bestseller, The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. And he was based in Israel-Palestine in East Jerusalem from 2016 to 2020. So we're going to talk to Anthony about his work on how Israel basically uses the occupied territories as a testing ground for tools of war and surveillance, and what's going on right now in Gaza.
And he also is the subject of an interesting short documentary about being a Jew who opposes Israel.
All right, let's go to Anthony Lowenstein.
So excited to be talking to Anthony Lowenstein, who's the author of, among other books, The Palestine Laboratory, or as you would say, Anthony, Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. So can you give people an overview of how Israel does export the technology of occupation around the world?
One of the things that I investigate in this book is that pretty much since Israel's birth in 1948, very soon after that, Israel really saw the need to make friends. Now, obviously, new nations make friends. That's not entirely unusual. But the way that they did that was trying to build a domestic arms industry. Back then, obviously, it was pretty basic weapons. But pretty much from the mid to late 50s, they're already selling weapons, including to Germany, West Germany then. Fast forward to 1967, there's obviously the Six-Day War. Israel takes over huge amounts of territory of Palestine. And really, the trajectory from then to now, so close to 55, 60 years, is that Israel has used the occupied Palestinian territories as a testing ground for a range of tools and technologies to control Palestinians. By doing so, they use it as a very effective marketing tool. So they say to many nations, and this happened before 67, but it's certainly accelerated since, even nations that publicly were opposed to the occupation, who would say this is terrible, you should end the occupation, Israel's been very effective, from its perspective, to promote a way to control so-called enemy populations. So we're talking about South Africa during apartheid, Guatemala in the 80s when they're literally committing genocide, Iran before 79. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And one of the reasons I wrote the book, this obviously is more the historical part, though, is that many people know about the US role in backing autocracy around the world since 1945. That's more known on the left, at least. What's far less known is that Israel often was doing exactly the same thing, often in concert with the US, in many of the same countries, to the point where, for example, in Chile after 1973, when Pinochet takes over, at various points, I have this in the book, declassified documents, the US is saying that Israel, in fact, is providing more weapons to Pinochet than the Americans were even. So the so-called laboratory is what Israel is doing in Palestine, and as a way to promote what they say is an effective way to control an occupied population. Now, obviously, in the modern age, just briefly after 9/11, which on paper had nothing to do with Israel, although you could argue indirectly it did, there was a massive explosion in Israel's defense sector that they were saying to the world, you want to fight a war on terror, so-called war on terror, let us show you how to do it. And in the last 24 years, Israel's defense sector has soared. And that is not really changing, I would argue, since October 7 either.
You refer to Israel's weapons industry and surveillance industry as an insurance policy. Can you elaborate on that concept?
So I think this insurance policy, again, the caveat is a little bit of being what's happened since October 7, but we can talk about that in a minute. But essentially what I mean by that is even nations, after 1967, there were many nations that, as I said, publicly oppose what Israel was doing. You must give the territory back, stop occupying Palestinians. But the insurance policy, what Israel has been selling weapons and surveillance tech to so many countries for so long, that those nations often were either less likely to criticize Israel where it matters, like the UN. And for example, often what Israel has been doing, both during Netanyahu's era, but certainly before, is to almost use surveillance tech and weapons as a way to get more support at the UN for certain votes. Now, obviously, if you look at most UN votes, it's pretty much the entire world on one side. This has been the case for years. The entire world on one side. And the other side is Israel, the US, Palau, Micronesia, and often Australia, shamefully, my country. But pretty much on the face of it, it seems like the whole world's against Israel, at least at the UN. But that's obviously not the reality. Putting aside, obviously, the US's important role, it's the fact that Israel has been selling, and I calculate, no one even knows, by the way, how many countries Israel has sold weapons to. I calculate anywhere between 125 and 145 nations, which is the majority of nations on the planet, have bought some form of Israeli weapons, surveillance tech, repressive technology, including, I might add, in the Arab world. And it's pretty clear, and this again was the case before October 7, but since, no Arab nation has actually truly cut ties with Israel, and none of them will. Yes, they've been critical. Yes, they've said what Israel's doing is terrible, it should stop. But let's be clear, none of them have cut ties and they won't. Why? I say in the book, and I think this is proven correct since October 7, all those nations, I'm talking about Saudi, UAE, Bahrain, the list goes on, they have many reasons for doing what they're doing. But I think a key reason is they are so desperate and they have received massive amounts of repressive technology from Israel long before October 7. They want to maintain a relationship with Israel to get close to the US, and that I think would be one key reason that the Abraham Accords, these so-called normalization deals that were struck at the end of the Trump era, were nothing about peace. It was about an arms deal between all those nations and Israel. They got what they wanted. Israel got so-called friendship. And of course, all those nations though are petrified of their own people. I mean, look, if you look at what's happened since October 7, most of the Arab nations, where they're allowed to protest or at least tried, if you poll Arabs or most Muslims, frankly, in all those nations, they all fundamentally oppose their own government's deals with Israel. And the governments know that. And they're all petrified of the Arab Spring happening again. This is the Arab elites. To me, it seems like Israel has tried to convince both itself and others that they are increasingly welcomed in the Arab Muslim world. But in fact, that's nonsense. With Arab elites, they are. Yes, there's increasing traffic between Dubai and Tel Aviv. That's undeniably true. But if you ask the majority of people in all those Arab nations, and I think it has a lot to do with Israeli repressive tech, which, as I say in my book, they've been selling this stuff for about a decade, talking about phone hacking tools, surveillance technology. So Israel is essentially claiming to be the only democracy in the Middle East, which obviously is nonsense, but they're selling repressive technology to other states to repress their own people. And it's kind of a house of cards, I think. I think Israel's position and so-called security is a house of cards long before October 7th, I would argue.
And since October 7th, how have we seen Israel put the Palestine Laboratory into action?
You know, one of the things that happened very quickly on October 7th was during the Hamas attack was how easily, obviously it took a lot of work for Hamas to do this, but the so-called security around Gaza evaporated immediately. Hamas was able to breach both the so-called security barrier, the wall that I've been through many times when I've visited Gaza as a journalist in the last 15 years. They knocked out pretty much, they made Israel blind essentially for 10 or 15 hours. And you would think on the face of it, that would mean that many countries would say, why would we trust you, Israel, to sell us surveillance and repressive technology when you yourself have not protected your own people? And I've seen no evidence of that. And what I mean by that is that it's early days. We don't know exactly what arms deals are going to happen in the coming months and years. That's true. But what we've seen in Gaza pretty much since October 7, pretty much starting on October 8th, Israel has been testing huge amounts of weapons in Gaza. I'm talking about surveillance drones, so-called quadcopters, which basically are killer drones, drones that kill people with a weapon, robot dogs, both American and Israeli companies. I'm talking about various other kinds of surveillance tech, and they're using that and trying to promote that globally. So there's been two major arms fairs globally since October 7. There's been many others, but two major ones. Paris late last year and Singapore near me a few months ago. And at both those arms fairs, Israel had a large presence, both as a state and private Israeli defense companies. And they are promoting tools and technologies they are using in Gaza openly, battle tested. I mean, I use that word, but so do they. Now, obviously, we don't know exactly who's buying those weapons yet, but you can be rest assured, as history shows, that unless there is a political or economic price for Israel doing these actions to committing mass slaughter in Gaza, these weapons will continue to flow. There are many, many nations that are very keen, from Cambodia to Vietnam to Singapore, vast parts of the Arab world, in countries, I would argue, in Latin and South America that have been vocally against what Israel is doing, history would suggest they're very keen to still buy some of that tech. So, Aaron, that what they've been doing is they've been live testing weapons in Gaza, promoting it often on social media. And this is what I talk about in the book. There's almost this feedback loop that Israel in the last 10 years realized that the way that they promoted themselves globally wasn't working anymore. What I mean by that is that Israel had believed, with some justification, that for many, many years, not that they controlled the media, but they were able to shape the narrative pretty effectively from their perspective. Of course, there were always critics and obviously Palestinians who didn't share that view. But if you, there was a study I quote in the book, I think it was a study of looking at how many opinion pieces in the New York Times from 1970 to like 2010, like 2% written by Palestinians. I mean, just an insane erasure of Palestinians. That's changing a little bit. But social media changes the game. So Israel has got a whole army of social media warriors, I'm talking about employed by the state in Israel and globally, trying to pump out propaganda. Now, you could argue how effective or not that has been since October 7. I would argue not particularly effective in some circles. But the caveat always I say to people is, yes, for those of us on the left, Israel lost the left years ago. Except for Germany, which is a whole weird, as you know, exception to the rule. But in many parts of the global right and far right, Israel has never been more popular. And that's in fact growing since October 7. And as the right in Europe and elsewhere is surging in support, I think we are mistaken if we think that what Israel's doing in Gaza in some circles does not elicit more support and solidarity. And the weapons are a key part of that.
And when it comes to surveillance, like for an average citizen in Gaza prior to October 7th, how deeply surveilled are they by Israel?
All communication in and out of Gaza is monitored. Now, it doesn't mean every single conversation is listened to. It's like the NSA, as we know, in the US monitors every conversation, but not like every single call is listened to by, you know, Joe Biden. Of course, it doesn't work that way. But every communication is monitored and tracked. That's done by a unit called 8200, which is Israel's kind of NSA, essentially. And so all forms of communication, phone calls, mobile cell phone calls, emails, social media. If a Gazan wants to get in and out of Gaza to go to education outside, to go to medical care, just to travel, there has been massive amounts of surveillance done on those individuals before they have to be interviewed by an Israeli officer at usually the at Erez, which is the border crossing between Israel and Gaza. I have many friends of mine in Gaza, some of whom are still there, some of whom have got out, who have got out since October 7, but have talked about what that surveillance means, that the information that Israel has on an individual who has no connection with terrorism or anything is extraordinary. And that's because of both human intelligence. Israel has, we don't really know the numbers of people, but Israel has over the years used a number of Palestinians to spy on Palestinians. That's not exactly a breaking news story. Now, how many? We have no idea. I don't think it's tens of thousands, but it's a decent number. Although it's interesting, since October 7, I would argue it's pretty clear that Israel is operating fairly blind, actually, in Gaza, despite spending insane amounts of money on so-called intelligence for years. So there are drones that monitor Gaza 24/7. When I've been there over the years, many times you hear low level, only see them in the sky. Some of them are armed, some of them are not. And since October 7, though, there's been a massive expansion of this that, again, I've been reporting on this and I have friends of mine who have seen this with their own eyes in Gaza, a huge expansion of facial recognition technology and biometric tools documenting and monitoring and recording Palestinians, often when they're being forcibly moved from point A to point B, from the north to the south, from Rafah to somewhere else, God knows where. And that information, like we're seeing increasingly in the West Bank in the last years, of a growing attempt to document every single Palestinian citizen. Now, what I mean document, I mean building a profile of that person. What do they do? Where do they think? What are they writing on social media? Where do they want to go? And what Israel has often done, both in the West Bank, although, of course, Gaza is more sealed than the West Bank, is often weaponize that information to curtail people's freedom of movement. So, for example, it's not unusual in the West Bank, and indeed I've heard in Gaza too, of Israel trying to blackmail gay Palestinians, or for that matter, someone who is not so-called officially gay, you know, is a straight man married to a woman, is having an affair with a man, for example, or vice versa, whatever the sexual orientation, Israel will weaponize that and say, just happened many times, we will expose this to your wife, to your family, unless you spy for us. And again, we don't know the numbers of people who are essentially giving into that. Many people I know basically say F you and they won't spy for Israel. But I'm sure some do because they're petrified of being shamed in their own community. So Israel grossly weaponizes intelligence against Palestinians, which has been the case for years. There was evidence of this at least 15 years ago, and I'm sure it's happening. I know it's happening now.
What about the way that weapons have been used against protesters here protesting Israel's assault on Gaza?
One of the relationships between Israel and the US, which has got some attention, but not nearly enough, is after 9/11, there was a push, as I said before, by many in the pro-Israel lobby and Israel to try to sort of make the Israeli way, so-called way, of dealing with trouble, as in Palestinians, as an example to how American police forces could treat their own people. And what I mean by that is American police don't need to go to Israel to learn to be racist. some American police are going to be racist for historical reasons, a range of reasons. They don't need Israel for that. But what's happened after 9/11, a few years after the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, began these police training tours, basically, between both countries. Many police forces, senior police, went to Israel to spend time with the police and the military to learn what they claim was counterterrorism techniques, essentially. And there's huge amounts of evidence, not just since October 7, but before, of American police forces. Again, not every American police man or woman has gone to Israel, but many have. And this program has continued during COVID. It took a bit of a break for obvious reasons because of travel restrictions. But there was a lot of internal debate, from my understanding, within the ADL, which is, in my view, a grossly extremist organization that should not get any kind of credit for documenting hate at all. But that's not how most of the media views it. There are a number of ADL members who have left. Staff members who have left in the last years, right, as you guys know, because of this training, because of this unhealthy relationship, and yet this training continues. So it's hard to say that every single police force that's repressing peaceful protesters in America got trained by Israel, but some certainly have. And it's not just the training, it's also the ideology. It's about saying that when you go to Israel, and you spend time as a policeman or woman training with Israeli police, what a lot of people on this podcast, they would know, but the wider population might not know, is that Israeli police and border police particularly have a brutal record of abusing Palestinians. I mean, I'm not even talking about even in Palestine. I'm talking about within Israel itself. Forget about Palestine for a minute. So that kind of police exchange, which, by the way, is not just happening with the US. There is Israel is training police in Kashmir, in many other countries. This, again, is how the laboratory works. Israel selling itself as the model. To me, the danger of that and the awareness I think that more and more Americans are now having, especially since October 7, the brutal crackdown on many peaceful protesters in your country, I think is showing people that Israel is not the model we want to follow. Now, we say that, but many other nations disagree. And the one I focus on in the book just briefly is India, because I think India is, it's the biggest country in the world. It's the largest population in the world. Modi is about to get a third term. He's increasingly a Hindu fundamentalist leader who wants to, well, there's 200 million Muslims in India, and there is a real attempt to isolate and target them. There are regular pogroms against them. And the relationship between India and Israel today very much reminds me, as I say in the book, of Israel and South Africa back in the day. This is a defense relationship, but it's also an ideological relationship where they share, obviously, one's a Hindu nation, one's a Jewish nation. But there is an understanding that as an ethno-nationalist state, we need to behave in a certain way. And that's the kind of training that American police are getting in Israel when they go there.
There was also this incident at Columbia where students think that they were sprayed with skunk water. I don't know if you saw.
Yeah, I did. Look, I can't say much beyond what I saw in the reports. I mean, what people probably might not know is that that is a very common tactic of Israeli forces in the West Bank to go after peaceful protesters, either Jewish protesters or Palestinians. And I've seen it happen. I mean, I've, you know, lived for many years in Palestine, and I've seen it with my own eyes how this works, that it's a so-called crowd control technique. Again, something which can be exported to other areas. And it's pretty clear in the last few months that, although this is obviously happening under the Biden administration, there is a growing interest in even more to militarize the American police, which is deeply disturbing. And there's a growing attempt to find ways to, like happened in the 1960s against student protests against Vietnam, to infiltrate these protests against the genocide in Gaza. And I don't think it will work. I just don't. I mean, there could be, I'm sure there are infiltrators. I don't doubt that for a second. Who knows how many? I'm sure there are. But good luck trying to, I mean, this is the same logic, right? Where they're trying to ban TikTok in America because some politicians worry that American young people are suddenly interested in Palestine. Let's ban the app that they're getting the information on it. Nice try, guys. Good luck with that. I mean, sort of, it's so laughable and yet dangerous. And I'm not a blind defender of TikTok. TikTok is problematic for a thousand reasons. But the idea that you would try to ban an app because you're worried that young Americans are engaged and concerned by mass slaughter in Gaza just seems like a slightly wrong way to deal with the problem.
When it comes to the corporations involved in the Palestine Laboratory, who are some of the major players and who are some firms that whose involvement might surprise people?
I'm not sure the first example will surprise people, but one of the, it has got a bit of press in the last few months, is something called Project Nimbus, which some of your viewers will have maybe heard about. This is a project that was launched a few years ago with Google and Amazon, essentially providing cloud services to Israel, including the military. This existed before October 7, and there's very, very concerning questions around those companies' involvement since October 7, because Israel has been using artificial intelligence warfare against the Palestinian population in Gaza. Google and Amazon directly complicit in those potential war crimes. Palantir, obviously, a large American company, surveillance company with a huge global reach, has partnered with the Israeli government. And I should just say, with in relation to Amazon and Google, although some of your viewers will know this, there has been massive protests within those companies against what their bosses are doing, building deep connections. There's also a growing tie between Silicon Valley in the US and Israel. And this was happening before October 7, but it's actually accelerating since, that Israel economically is obviously taking a hit to an extent because they're in war and they are spending insane amounts of money on the war in Gaza. And many, many Silicon Valley investors are increasingly seeing a viable path to supporting Israeli defense companies. This is happening before October 7, but in fact, it's increasing. Another company, which is an Israeli one but has influence in the US, is Elbit. Elbit is Israel's biggest defense company, very involved in the war in Gaza, amongst other places, of course. There are Elbit surveillance towers along the US-Mexico border. That's been the case for a number of years. It started during Obama. It continued during Trump. It finished during Biden, which I think shows, just as a brief aside, that this is really bipartisan in the US. That, yes, I think Trump's potential immigration policies disturb me greatly. But it's not like Biden in the last 3 years has had a liberal, wonderful, open border policy. Let's be clear. And in fact, what Biden has been doing is deepening that high-tech surveillance that was started during Obama and continued during Trump.
And just to further that, back when Biden was desperate to get billions of more dollars for the Ukraine proxy war and billions of dollars more for Israel, he basically agreed to accept all of Trump's anti-immigrant policies just to win Republican support. And then the deal collapsed because Trump didn't want to let Biden be more anti-immigrant than him. So that deal collapsed. But Biden, for all his rhetoric about respecting immigrants, has undermined it.
Totally. I agree. And it's worth saying also in 2020, in your last election cycle, that there were many of these private contractors who work on the border, including Elbit, who in fact were giving more money to the Democrats than the Republicans. Now, how that's going to play out this year, we'll have to wait and see. But I think that's because, as you rightly say, Aaron, all these companies know it's not going to make a huge difference who wins on this issue in November. I mean, I would argue that Trump's immigration policies might be worse, but nonetheless, the brutality will continue regardless of who's going to win. And these American corporations, Google, Amazon, Palantir, and others, are so deeply complicit. And I think, frankly, are open to massive boycott campaigns. Now, one could say, how do you boycott Google? I mean, it's not easy. Google is sort of everywhere, as is Amazon in a way. But I think there is a real importance to make people aware that you have all these companies, major companies, that are so deeply complicit in what Israel is doing. And I think there's one interesting point just finally, that in the contract of Project Nimbus, it's written into the contract that even if there is an attempt to try to boycott those companies, the contract would still continue. It's like a little clause written in the contract. Now, that Mark, almost exactly you could say smart, yes, from their perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, I would say in the end that won't work, not tomorrow or next week, but years down the track. But look, I think what you'll find is that as Israel, and I think this has slightly changed since October 7th. I mean, let's be clear, the headwinds in some countries still remains very pro-Israel. There's no doubt about that. But you will see in the coming months and years, I don't doubt that, some countries will impose arms embargoes. It won't be the US, of course. It won't be the UK. It won't be Australia. Some countries will. And it is possible, I think, that some countries, including maybe in Western Europe, impose sanctions. I mean, Belgium, for example, has talked in the last month. Belgium's not a massively powerful country, but it is a Western European state, talking about potentially imposing sanctions on Israel. That was reported in the Israeli press last month. I think Israel is well aware of these potential headwinds, which is even more reason why they're going to be looking for investment from Silicon Valley and elsewhere in years ahead. And it's why I would argue that their arms industry, which the latest figures we have just finally was 2022, we haven't got the figures from 23 yet, $12.5 billion US, massive, the highest by a mile ever. I'm almost positive last year is going to be more. And some of that, though not all, was coming after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, where a lot of European nations flocked to Israel saying, please, please, please sell us all your missile defense shields and various other surveillance tech. And Israel was happy to do so. And I've seen no indication, by the way, since October 7th that that has changed from those European states at all. None.
What is Israel's goal in this attack on Gaza, this war on Gaza, this genocidal war?
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
That was great.
Very cool. And once again, Anthony Lowenstein's book, which Katie is holding up, is called The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World.
Yeah, that's great. And definitely check out the extended interview. If you're not already subscribers, you should become subscribers, because the extended interview with Anthony is really fascinating. And he talks about his experience in Gaza. And it's also, we'll also put a link to the documentary that he's featured in,
which is called Not In My Name. And it aired in Australia, got a big reception.
Yeah.
And it's available around the world too. Well, he continues in a fine tradition of just really brave, insightful Australians, Julian Assange, Caitlin Johnstone, John Pelger.
RIP, yeah.
Kylie Minogue, you could argue, you know, is in that tradition.
I mean, the Crocodile Dundee guy.
Paul Hogan, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So thank you, Australia, for all you've given us.
Yeah.
And thank you to our audience for tuning in. Our website is usefulidiotspodcast.com to support the show. We really appreciate your support. You keep us going. We have a limited offer going on. It's a special deal. It's flying off the digital shelves, where if you click the link in the show's description, you get 30% off for one full year of Useful Idiots. It's a hot deal. Take advantage while you can. And we'll see you next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at Useful Idiot Pod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.